I was kind of listening and looking around and seeing that I kind of felt like there's a which of these things is not like the others at the table, and I definitely fit into that mold. Nursing is a second career for me, and I was a high school teacher for about 15 years and decided to go back because I was feeling pretty burned out with adolescents. I was still loving the bad kids that I was teaching. I worked with kids with emotional differences and drug and behavior issues and so forth. But you just knew that I wasn't giving them as much as I could. So nursing, after a lot of soul searching, seemed to be a good fit for me. And when I found community health nursing, it was even a better fit. So I feel pretty fortunate because some people don't find that even once in their lives. Yes. Okay, sorry, I'm not the loudest speaker. Okay. Excuse me. As you know, what I'd like to focus on today is end of life care for victims and civilians of war. It's a pretty pervasive issue, has become more so in the 3 years that I've worked on an inpatient hospice unit here in the Chicagoland area. And the unit where I work is a freestanding unit, not attached to a hospital. So some of its practices or more so its culture, I think, are a little bit different because I had done rotations on units that were in fact connected to hospitals and were for-profit as opposed to non-profit. And so as you can imagine, that was a very different experience for me. So again, I kind of was fortunate to fall into the right thing. Excuse me, I've also got a sore throat. The overarching, I think, theme of this is that obviously, however one is impacted by war and violence and conflict in the world, whether that is through military service for which they've been involved or military service for which they have seen as a a way of bettering their lives and finding something for themselves that they don't see in their neighborhoods or within their families. I think there are still some commonalities about how they experience those things and what kinds of effects those ongoing kinds of stressors and witnessing to the trauma and the violence and the suffering that they do has on their physiological health as well as their psychological health. And we have a lot of research on their mental health. What I have noticed over the last 3 years is that as our Holocaust survivors are, dwindling, there aren't nearly as many of them left. Anecdotally, I have started to see some similarities among how some of the coping mechanisms that they use at the end of life and that their families and friends also have at the end of the life when they're trying to help them have a peaceful transition. Of course, I want to give the caveat that nobody's the same. And so when I say that, I'm not, by no means am I saying that I stereotype them and say, okay, well, this person has this cultural background or this educational background or socioeconomic status or anything like that, but there certainly are some things that that you can see at times that seem to be a function of what they've been through and of long-term stress and long-term witnessing to violence and suffering. Rachel Yehuda has done some studies out of Mount Sinai on the effects of trauma on and the physiological consequences of it from one generation to the next in epigenetics. And we tend to think of genetic transformations and mutations as something that has to occur, you know, obviously over decades or generations. These are not that the genes are being changed, but it is what she has found is that there are some cellular responses to the genes that are mediated by hormones that may be a result of the stress that certain groups of individuals are experiencing. She found very similar levels of cortisol, which is our stress hormone, as most of you know, I guess, or all of you know, between Vietnam veterans and Holocaust survivors and also Holocaust survivors' children. And so what she then began to study was how quickly that can be translated from one generation to the next. And it was pretty amazing, the effects that she saw between those generations. Another thing that she studied were the women who survived but were expecting children during and working at the World Trade Center during the 9/11 attacks. She found that if they were in their second and third trimesters, there was an enzyme that was affected by the stress and the shock of that experience of being there. And it across the board, babies who were born who had been in utero during that time had a much lower birth weight than babies generally. And of course, that's if you can isolate other variables and so forth, but which is hard to do. But it did seem to be pretty significant. The babies who were in their first trimester during it did not have the same type of effect, and her hypothesis was that there was something happening physiological that allowed their bodies to kind of balance itself and get back to that place of homeostasis so that they didn't suffer maybe quite as much of a loss of being able to thrive in utero during that time. So why am I talking about this? Because obviously the experience of war and trauma causes trauma, or the experience of war and conflict causes trauma. In a class, I'm taking my last public health class this semester, and I had sort of a paradigm shift at the beginning of the semester because I have worked with veterans, with Vietnam veterans, and then also doing their life stories, a couple of them who had lost their veteran benefits because they'd been dishonorably discharged. They were African American, and the problems that they kind of incurred were during the riots in the late 60s. And in their mind, in my mind, everybody who knows them, you know, it was not something that was that was valid. And I think obviously we've come back, haven't learned a lot from those kinds of mistakes, obviously, and we're still imposing a lot of trauma on different populations, and mistreatment and imbalance and disparity has not necessarily grown very much since, or the lack of disparity has not been affected very much since then. Anyway, I did that, but I also worked with veteran students who from the wars in Afghanistan, and I think a couple who had seen combat in the wars in Iraq. I'm sorry, the wars in Iraq, yeah, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but they were coming back to nursing school at UIC, where I go to school, and were having a trouble, obviously, acclimating to just college life. And being in classes with people who had not maybe seen what they'd seen and had not experienced some of the things that none of us should have to experience, and then also struggling academically with the effects of the stress and possible PTSD of having seen conflict. But they were determined to stay in nursing school, and they felt like they had found a good niche as nurses, in that they wanted to take care of people, obviously, and wanted to relieve suffering, and felt like they also had the skills that they had learned in the military to be able to, triage and prioritize things and do things quickly and all the things that you hear about nursing. And I'm going to switch the slide in just a second and then go a little bit faster with the rest of it. So, nonetheless, at the beginning of the semester, my misunderstanding had always been that suicide rate in this country of veterans, which is now at on average 22 per day, as most of you have probably heard, was those veterans who had seen combat. What I found out pretty quickly in that class as I blurted that out was that it's in fact not the ones who've seen combat. The higher incidence of suicide comes from those veterans and military and those who are still in the military who were not deployed. And so obviously they join the military, you know, for whatever reason, connectedness, a sense of belonging, a sense of doing, of creating some meaning for their lives, and they did not get to get deployed, and that was the kind of the thing that, you know, that they were looking for and that they really missed, and it cost them an incredible amount of emotional distress, obviously, and a higher rate of those individuals ended up and committed suicide. So I had always heard that if anybody sees combat, they automatically have an amount of PTSD, which I tend to believe, not having seen any combat, but certainly talked to enough people who have, and it made, that made sense to me. But I'd not thought about the loss and the grief of kind of investing yourself in what you believe is the right thing to do. Thank you. Okay. Okay. So. Trauma gets inherited, obviously, and we talked about it from generation to generation, and I think I'll move on because I've spent too much time there. I don't have anything to disclose or any financial relationships or otherwise. So what is our obligation as public health nurses? We need to address the sociocultural needs of diverse communities and continually strive to develop greater cultural humility. It can be achieved through a broader awareness of values, beliefs, traditions, customs, and a history of various communities, but we have to be aware that some of those communities are not immediately evident to us. We have lots of education, cultural competency education about race, ethnicity, faith, tradition, probably not enough, not nearly enough, socioeconomic standards, age and generation, gender identity, those other things that you see there, but not nearly enough in my mind and what I do for those who are affected by conflict and war. So the numbers, you know, 44.7 million individuals in the U.S. are 65 or older in 2013. About 1.5 million of those individuals received hospice care. 43% of the U.S. deaths in 2013 occurred in hospice care. 23 million veterans from the wars through the 1990s involving the U.S. are still living, and that does not include the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, so we have our work cut out for us. 25% of the deaths that occur in the U.S. each year, those are military veterans, so a quarter of the deaths in the U.S. each year are military veterans. And then we also have 60 million refugees quite recently and also internally displaced people as a result of war and conflict in 2014, according to the Global Peace Index. All of that confounds what we're talking about as far as the far-reaching effects of trauma. The APH policy, one of the APH policies is to support the health, public health role in addressing unmet needs at the end of life. Some of those involve the, you know, older adults and the baby boomers, obviously, naturally, are creating a public health burden. So there's a need for new strategies. We need to be centered more on patient care and caregivers and improved palliative care. Okay. And then the end-of-life considerations for veterans are that they have characteristics that keep them from experiencing as peaceful deaths as possible. They're very stoic, World War II veterans especially, likely to deny pain, other discomfort. They don't want help with their ADLs. They want to do things autonomously, which makes sense. And they're more likely than non-veterans to actually enter hospice. They resist heroic measures, and they have increased levels of anxiety, terminal agitation, and restlessness that are often misdiagnosed as mental health problems. There is just a quote from Kevin Powers, who wrote The Yellow Birds, and it's a novel about his experience in Iraq or about a recent veteran's experience in Iraq. I'd be glad to get this to you later, but I think that my time's up, so I'm going to skip over that. But the point is that being in war, being in conflict, has obviously far-reaching ramifications for not only the individual, but for their families, for everybody who knows them, for the rest of the community. And we all, I believe, all have sort of an obligation to try to help them and pave a little bit more of a smoother path for them as they reach the end of their lives. And then there's the history of all the wars we've been involved in, and I could talk about that, but we don't have time. And here are some suggestions for what to do with our patients. So I apologize for not managing my time well, but if you would like, I could get you the handouts and other, or talk to you later. And then there's systemic and organizational changes. Whoops. And then a quote by Jimmy Carter. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Izzo. So we are going to, I'm going to open the floor for discussion. So we still have 15 minutes. Do you have any questions? Okay.
So I'd like to ask the question of Julian, that should be relevant to everyone, about what do we need to do to change nurses who are very focused on particularly acute care to understand the connections between what they're doing on a daily basis with these broader social issues and structural issues we address. Is it a matter of reframing? What are the barriers to come together?
I'm going to give you an example. I'm a NICU nurse. So you can't get any more inpatient acute care than a NICU nurse, right? So I'm a NICU nurse, and I worked NICU for years, and technology improved, and we were able to care for smaller and smaller babies, and ventilators got better. But then when we got to 20 weeks, and we had babies that were born that early, 21, 22, nothing helped. So that was when the realization came to me, and this is when I went back to school for my, tell my colleague, public health degree. What happens to families before they get to us? And that's the piece, is like the light bulb went on for me, was that there is something that happens with mothers, fathers, families, and communities that women get in the hospital in preterm labor and deliver at 20, 21 weeks. And so I think about some of the work that we're doing. Some of the first clinical experiences with our students are in the community. We put them in the community before we put them in the hospital, because those are ways that you think about that are beyond what technology can do. We have to do more and do earlier.
I agree with Dr. Julian that it's about reframing nursing education and getting people, getting this into nurses' heads from the beginning. And not to say that people who are currently practicing are just framing them up, but I think that's a more complicated conversation possibly than really strongly including this in our nursing.
Thank you. Any common questions? If not, I have a question for Dr. Hector, because I did one of my study I did before is with the African American, adult. Because my that study was focused on the HIV prevention, and so then there is one challenge I encounter is the literacy. You know, because when we try to originally, we think, we try to do the survey and we find out, their education background is very, their preparation is pretty low. So they have very limitation to understand our structural questionnaire. So, and we find out in our pilot study, so we need to redesign the difficulty of the reading, the words and pick up the appropriate word for that population. So I'm wondering if that's because I saw the text message you send out, I'm thinking if for my population, because that population is from in the rural area, I see those text messages, the word you use may, I can see that's not appropriate for my research population. So I'm wondering if that's a problem you have there.
I'm going to take the mic because I want to make sure that I say first that literacy is not an African American problem. That would be across populations that you would suffer a literacy issue. that will certainly be in population. Sometimes it's mostly socioeconomic, it's zoning, it's a variety of a larger disparity issue like my colleagues have talked about, societal policy, so it's certainly not racial.
Mm-hmm.
But when you send text messages, however, to any population that has suffers disparity, which is likely to have low socioeconomical and educational attainment, you have to be aware of literacy issues. So our text messages are at a sixth grade literacy level, and that would be for any population, again, that I was going to try to send text messages to. So some of our examples, I've worked with my daughter who's here in the audience on crafting things to make sure that the literacy levels, that you don't use certain words that people don't understand. And so as a team, we work pretty hard to make sure that any message that we send out is on a level that anyone can understand. So what I kind of do with my team is in our library we send that message around, and we make sure that anyone could understand it. And we have various generations on our team. We have various people on our team, and that kind of helps, is to have a variety of people look at it and make sure that you're hitting a literacy level that. And we have lay people on our team who have. Because sometimes when you're looking through the lens of a PhD, it's difficult to remember that a word is not a common word. So, you know, like a word that we use commonly in languages, like, what, everybody doesn't say that? So we do take a good look at our text messages, because we are sending these to everybody, and they got to be short. So you got to be aware when you're sending a text message of every character, because characters count on a text message, not just, you know, words. So you're looking at characters. So we keep them short and tight, and we make sure that they're words that everybody, typically, you know, people abbreviate text messages, like U, Y-O-U is U, the letter U. So we don't do that in our text messages, but we do keep it short and make sure that everybody can, their words everybody can use commonly. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah.
The issue of engaging with your population before you do this research, before you design it, before you develop it, and every stage along the way, I think is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so your surveys, I remember going back to one of the parent training programs we did, and they were one of the standardized questionnaires that we had, and we were doing parent training in daycare centers. We went in the daycare center and we talked to the daycare staff and we said, this is the questionnaire that we'd like to use with the families that we want to recruit. And what they said to us was, this is insulting, this is insulting, this is negative, and where is the positive question on here? And so we took that as exactly the important information that it was, and we made adjustments in our questionnaires before we even got started. So I think up front, those changes in terms of listening to your population would help.
The focus groups are critical, because that's exactly why we did a focus group, to say, these are the messages you got. How were those messages to you? And if they said something to us, you know, we don't like that, or that insulted us, then we removed that message, or we couldn't understand that message, you know, or whatever, then it's important to do those focus groups and listen to the people that you're serving. They'll tell you what they like.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly what we did. You know, we did a focus group and find out, you know, the sixth grade literacy level is not appropriate for our population. So that's why we need to decrease to the third grade. So, you know, I apologize. You can see, you know, the English is my second language. So I try to, try to clarify, because this is, you know, we have a great relationship with our, you know, community people, and, you know, I really respect their, you know, their participation and their experience and knowledge into our study. Yeah. Do I have any comment or question? Yes.
Very real things that come as a result of not great approaches to care. Someone had a slide that showed about health professionals being in one of these middle class, that we need more health diversity in health professions. I think that's part of the key to this, is who we are as nurses. And we have typically been a body of white women, and we are changing that now, and that's going to change the conversation. I think the part of changing the conversation is changing who's at the table. And so if you change who's at the table, you'll have more interest in some social justice issues, because you're coming from the population that you want to serve, and you're coming from a different perspective. That's not the entire answer, it's the curriculum and all that, but I think part of the answer is who we bring to the table to have the conversation.
And I'll add something. I think it's important that we don't move our own values forward in our research and think ahead of time that what we think is important is what the community, those individuals who are involved in our research, also think is important. I'll give you an example. I was writing a proposal on heavy drinking behavior, and working with somebody called a name. But I was talking about, well, this one population we're working with is very poverty ridden. And we're going to have to go in and provide some incentives and measures and what have you. And people I was talking to said, you know what, they'll set up a savings account with whatever little money they have. Why should we go in and help? And so that, you know, it was very difficult for me to come back and explain to them, I don't even have savings account. That's your value. You may think it's important to save for the future. A lot of people are present oriented, okay? And don't take those steps, but we should be careful in the words we choose, and if we try to enforce some of our values. And also, speaking of words, in some of the research I do, words such as pain can mean something different in our community. Words such as depression, I get questions a lot. What do you mean by this? Do I think the blues? Sad? Oh, okay, I know what that is. But a word like depression that we're used to saying in our research all the time is not understandable or accepted in a lot of circles.
I want to add too that we also, as nurses, come to the end of the answer. So obviously we think we have the answers, and just the idea of not only talking to the labor providers to help us survey, but also talking to the actual community members and asking them what their needs are, but more importantly, maybe sometimes asking them what their assets are, what their strengths are. So just because they're not saving their money doesn't mean that they don't have some assets they're going to make some other part of their healthcare, you know, helping you impact some other part of their healthcare. Because they know what their assets are, and they have assets. They have things that they do.
They well, often know what their solutions are. You start asking them what they think will resolve certain things. They will come up with things that are very interesting.
Sure. And to speak to what you said as far as cultural competency, I think we wrap that up instead of doing cultural competency training, we can wrap it off and say, we don't know about this group and that group, and cultural, which is what I was trying to emphasize, that I don't know about that trans audience and think that's thing, but it doesn't mean I go in and expect that this guy's just going to observe. You know, if we listen to them 2 days ago, we have to get that culture of humility and be aware of our own baggage and our own experiences. Thanks for bringing up the situation.
That's right.
I just like to add one sort of comment to that is something that we tend to stay away from in nursing and perhaps other healthcare professions is the issue of race and racism. And so we don't teach students how to engage in those conversations. There are faculty who are uncomfortable engaging in those conversations. And racism has a huge impact on health and healthcare disparities and all those factors that are interconnected. And if we don't say it, we have to really address the elephant on the table that race does involve, it is connected with a lot of this. So that's something else I think that nobody can do. Probably other professions as well.
Okay, do we have any common question? You know, I can take the last one then. Okay, yes.
Let's say, in teaching students to deal with health disparities,
have very strong views in distributive justice and those types of things, and that just didn't play well with my audience, okay? And so what I did was I changed my whole approach, and I said, okay, here are the facts. Now, whether you're way over here or way over there, you've got to solve the problem. And so, for example, recently we did a unit on poverty, and the students had to review some material. They are working in the community, as we show, in other places. But a statistic that shocked everyone was that if you take people who are in deep poverty and they double their income, 47% of them are still in poverty. That one statistic changed the way the group of students thought about things. And I agree that racism is a significant issue. But just, you know, getting them to confront the statistics makes them move towards social justice. Not everybody, but more. So I found that, you know, making them struggle with, okay, here are the statistics, now you figure out the solutions.
Now, do you teach the nursing program?
Yes, yeah, so
what
was the composition
of
the class? Right now, the students I'm teaching right now, I would say probably 20% of them are students of color and or immigrants. But I have taught in the program where 60% of my students were immigrants from Africa.
I just say
my current one, so when I changed my approach was when I was doing online teaching, was totally online community health, and most of my students were rural, white, American. Okay? And they came in with all of their, you know, some were conversion students, they came in with all of their prejudices. And so,
I would just suggest that it's not the statistics that prompted them, it was your engagement with them and giving them the opportunity to add to the discussion and come up with possible solutions.
Right. So, and I use, I don't know if you're familiar with the website, procom.org. It gives both sides of the solutions, so I said, just look here. And I don't know which way, you know, because obviously there are a lot of opinions on procom.org that I don't agree with. But I simply say, look at all of it, and then they have discussions among themselves online, and they confront each other. And I found that that's much more effective, you know, just confronting them with some statistics and having them as a group identify each other.
Okay, thank you. The time is up, so I really appreciate your participation and your contribution to this session. Enjoy the rest of your meeting. Thank you.